Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg, and not the Mike Regan who was just nominated to lead the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, I will point out.
Did you actually get Twitter followers after the announcement, Mike?
Oh, after Wiesenthal congratulated me for the new job as a joke, I got about 20 or 30 new Twitter followers. So hopefully they'll stick around for the dad jokes and market commentary, even though I don't have a lot to offer on the environment. I'm a fan of the environment. I'm just not the guy in charge of it. So we'll leave it at that.
That's hysterical. That's hysterical. And for anyone who's not aware, Wiesenthal, that's Joe Wiesenthal. He's the host of the Odd Lots podcast at Bloomberg. He does plenty of other things as well here. But if you haven't checked out the Odd Lots podcast, please do. You can find it pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. But this week on the show, the U.S. dollar continues its decline as the MSCI All Country World Index trades at record highs. In addition to that, emerging market equities are on pace for their best quarter versus U.S. stocks since 2009. Will the momentum continue through next year and beyond? We get the state of play on international assets.
And as always, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sarah, I've got a contribution from none other than our Crazy Things correspondent, Vildana Heirich, who said to me, I'm not telling Sarah about this one. I'm giving it right to you. So I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, she didn't even tell me that she was going to do a roundabout and come to you. I had no idea this was coming. But I will say we also have a trifecta of guest write-ins. We have a voicemail. I got an IB, which for those who do not have a Bloomberg terminal, it's like instant message. It's your instant Bloomberg. And then I also got a direct message on Twitter. So we've got plenty of crazy things to share this week.
Thank goodness for that, right? But let's first start with that market talk that we know you all came for. And happy to have a new guest this week on the show. He runs the international and global mutual fund and ETF business at Davis Selected Advisors. His name is Danton Goey. Danton, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mike, for having me on board. Very excited.
Oh, great. You know, Danton, before we start talking about markets, I got to say, we get notes about the guests from, the PR people that you guys work with, our good friend Tyler Bradford in this case. I got to ask you first about something he pointed out, which I think is fascinating. Says, every summer, Danton travels to a new international destination to live with his family until school starts back up. That's fascinating to me. For one thing, I'm glad my kids don't listen to the podcast because I don't want them to know that's an option for summer vacation. Yeah. But I think that's a really cool tradition. Is that just for fun or is that as sort of an international equity specialist? Is it part of your research? You know, and you don't have to tell me what you're expensing on your expense account or not. But I'm curious if it's if it ties into your work or if it's just for fun.
Yeah, no, happy to talk to Mike to your kids about this. But no, it's absolutely.
He's gonna block you. He's not gonna let that happen.
It is absolutely part of our research process to go visit companies, you know, in their home markets, in their offices, and talk to the companies, talk to the competitors or suppliers or customers. And since we are a global fund, those companies are around the globe. You know, our team is based here in New York, meaning that we travel a lot. But this is a way to really spend, instead of, you know, a week or two on the ground in a country, to spend 2 or 3 months. And so for the last dozen years, we've been doing this with my wife, with the 3 kids. And we alternate between Asia one year and Europe the other year. You know, I grew up in France. And I was born in Germany. So, you know, Europe in some senses, my home. But my family is Indonesian Chinese and I speak Mandarin. So I feel comfortable in Asia as well. So both places have a lot of contacts. And then the last dozen years have been able to build that network. So it's been a really fantastic way to kind of build a network over time and visit these companies and a lot of the companies that we own in the portfolio. So yeah, I would highly recommend it.
So really quickly, before we get to the markets talk, I have to ask then, do you have a favorite country or a favorite place that you've ever lived?
You know, I think right now, one of the most exciting markets to be, and obviously 2020, you know, is sort of an asterisk, is an unusual year, but has been China over the last few decades to watch. You know, the first time I went to China was 1990, and it was a totally different country and market than it is today. But to be able to see the last three decades of evolution over there has been really fascinating. But of course, I have a soft part in my heart for France. That's where I grew up. That's where all my high school friends are. So it is always nice to go back home. It's where my mother still lives there. So it is nice to go home there as well. And of course, the quality of life can't be beat over there, and much more comfortable than China.
That's a great tradition, and your kids must really benefit from the education value of it, too. Sarah, I once was able to get a week in Jamaica to report about the stock exchange there, but Denton's got me beat, hands down, I think. This is
well, you'd have to persuade your kids, though, you know, because my kids go to Chinese summer camp with the locals in China or Taiwan or Hong Kong, depending on where we are. And then they go to summer camp, a French summer camp in France with the locals as well. You know, they've been kind of thrown in the deep end at an early age.
That's great, though. Well, Dan, one thing I wanted to ask you, let's dive into the markets now. And I was looking at the holdings of the Global Fund at Davis, done very well, very, very strong percentile performance. And correct me, some of these numbers might be outdated. You know, we're working off of whatever the most recent filings was, but about 40% of the global fund allocated to the U.S., at least of the last reporting we have for it. And here we are as the year sort of closes out here. And I think a big theme I keep hearing from investors is that everyone's looking outside of the U.S. for 2021, thinking that it's kind of time for international, for emerging markets to shine. Does that have you rethinking a big allocation to the U.S. at all, or are you just, you know, sticking with what's worked so far and not worrying about sort of the consensus and the zeitgeist out there with what everyone's talking about rotating to international?
Yeah, I mean, I think people, for good reason, are looking internationally. They have kind of said that, I think, the last 2 or 3 years, but the U.S. market has sort of just powered through anyways. But there is a good reason to look abroad. Right now, valuations are about 20-23%. Lower international markets on average than the U.S. market. So that's already a great starting point. And we know that the last decade, the U.S. market has been very strong, but these things go in cycles. So it's very possible the next decade, you know, international markets do as well, if not better, than U.S. markets. But, you know, we run a very focused portfolio of sort of 35, 40 sort of best of breed companies. So when we're looking at the U.S. market, we're not really investing in the overall market. We have a very concentrated and focused view of companies that we want to own. And we're finding, you know, very good opportunities there too. But we would say there's a lot of, you know, froth also in the U.S. market that you want to avoid. But underneath that, there are some very good values for sure. You know, some companies that have done well recently are still relatively attractive, I would say. We call them sort of the growth stalwarts. They're sort of the Googles, the Facebooks of the world. You know, they continue to be attractive on a valuation basis, on a long-term basis. But then you've got a whole host of stocks that have been out of favor now for a decade plus, right? The value stocks out there. And specifically, we're thinking about the financials and the banks that have been really out of favor, you know, basically since the financial crisis in 08, 09. So that was a long time ago. That are trading at really low valuations. In fact, when you look at the difference between the Russell 1000 growth versus the Russell 1000 value performance, it's amazing. It's a record gap in difference. So I think, you know, owning the market overall in the U.S., probably not recommended, but within that space, some great values.
Let's come back to something that you just walked us through. You mentioned the word froth, but then at the same time explained how there's growth stalwarts. And just because you're a company that's performed very, very well over the last year, over the last decade, it doesn't necessarily mean that your time is over. Can you give us a sense of where you do see the froth, the areas where you see risk or that you would avoid, and then maybe bring us through some of the misconceptions that there are?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of companies that have done great in the past few years, and specifically in 2020, that have, you know, up 3, 4, 5, 6 times, maybe even this year. But where the valuations in our mind, and we're, you know, we're value investors, don't make much sense. And they're great companies. They make great products. And I'm thinking, you know, specifically of a company like Tesla, which has done great, right? I mean, all Tesla shareholders have been very happy in 2020. But when we look at it and, you know, and see that they manufacture something like 350,000 cars and have a over $600 billion market cap, and then you look at General Motors that manufactures 7.7 million vehicles and has a $60 billion, you know, so one-tenth of the market cap, you know, one of those two things is probably wrong there in terms of how the numbers will play out over time. You know, we don't own some of these stocks and they've done great in 2020, so kudos to whoever owns them. But we would say just on a valuation basis, there's quite a bit of froth in some of these. You know, there's just momentum in some of the parts of the market.
You know, Tetson, looking at some of the top holdings across a few of the funds at Davis, a lot of the big sort of market dominating firms in their industries are pretty heavily weighted. Alibaba in China, Amazon, Alphabet, Facebook here in the U.S. And at the same time, there's this big buzz about the antitrust issue, not only in the U.S., but in China. You know, Tencent and Alibaba recently getting fined because of some of their mergers in the past. I'm curious how you're thinking about that issue, antitrust. Is it necessarily a scary thing to be threatened with an antitrust probe?
Yeah, it's certainly something that's in the news that's been, you know, growing as an issue over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, one that some of these companies like Google has been dealing with actually for a while now. I mean, in fact, they have been under investigation and dealing with sort of fines and remedies in the European Union for 5 years now already. And they've been operating under that. And actually, I mean, that's a good case where despite all of that and a very strict and aggressive antitrust policy, they have actually done fine in Europe. Their market share is actually even stronger than in the U.S. and it's well over 90% search market share, and their results have been very strong. So they've been able to adapt and operate well despite that. I mean, in some ways, of course, it's a little bit of a badge of honor in the sense that you've become so big, so successful, right? People will have become very worried about you. And it does make sense as a society that we are concerned about these huge companies, and they should be regulated. And so the regulators are definitely playing a little bit of catch up here. But in terms of an investor, you have to really think about, okay, what has happened in the past? You know, it's been relatively benign. What are the possible risks? And like you said, Mike, I mean, that would be a draconian measure. We haven't really seen that happen before very often, is sort of the breakup and sort of the demerger of companies that have been merged for several years. But even if that does happen, it doesn't mean like this business is being nationalized and confiscated, right? And then China, it's interesting. I mean, they've actually had a much laxer antitrust policy than even the U.S. So in some ways, they've been sort of more capitalistic than the U.S. But now they're realizing that they need to also, some behaviors are gotten too extreme. Online retailers are forcing brands to choose one of the platforms. You know, that's probably not great for consumers, right? It raises prices, it reduces selection. They are intervening, and it does make sense.
Antitrust concerns is a quasi badge of honor. That's a different way to look at it. I wanted to ask you, Danton, say you are a U.S. investor and odds are you maybe have a home bias and you have a very, very large allocation to the U.S. We talk about how maybe it's a good time to start allocating internationally, but can you walk us through certain areas, certain countries, certain regions that you think are ripe for growth right now and maybe would make a good investment at this point in time?
Yeah. So I think when you go internationally, you have to be extremely selective. You know, in our funds, we really limit the number of countries that we're invested in. You know, there's, for example, 26 emerging markets. We're really only in sort of 3 or 4 of them. And that's because, you know, the concerns around economic growth, political stability, sort of market access, things like that are important. Things that you maybe worry a little less in the U.S., you have to pay a lot more attention to when you're looking at an international market. So when we look through that and see which markets we think look really interesting, you know, China continues to look interesting. It's had, I guess, overall a pretty good year, but it's still under somewhat a cloud. You know, you definitely still hear rumblings of the U.S.-China geopolitical strain out there and tension. And that's not going away, even if there is a change in administration happening right now. So that's definitely true. But the conditions over there for economic growth are still quite strong. I mean, in fact, this year, China is going to be probably the only large economy that's going to grow. They're looking at sort of a 2%, you know, which is still not heroic, but, you know, with what happened with COVID and the pandemic, that's still pretty strong, 2% growth, whereas most countries, including the U.S., we're probably going to, you know, we're in the middle of a recession. And then next year, expectations are sort of 7-8% growth. So obviously pretty strong rebound off of a slow year. You know, increasingly the companies there, because of course you're not investing in the country or the market, you're investing in individual companies. The management teams, you know, keep on getting better and better, really high quality entrepreneurial management teams. And then the quality of the companies, they have some leading technologies there. If you think about, you know, who the top, say, cloud computing companies out there, of course you think of, you know, Amazon and Microsoft and Google, but the fourth largest is now a Chinese company, the Alibaba. Outside of China, I think Southeast Asia also looks pretty attractive. I mean, it's a conglomeration of sort of six or seven countries, but together they have about a population of around 600 million people. So that's almost half the size of China, for example. So a very large market together. That is, the demographics are favorable, where the economic growth is strong. So I think that's a pretty interesting area to look at. You know, then Latin America, I think long-term also would be interesting.
It's pretty fascinating, Danton, to talk to a guy like you who has sort of discretion to invest anywhere in the world, basically, for at least a few of these funds. And I'm just, you know, it's such a huge universe of stocks out there around the world. I'm curious how your process works. You know, how do you start narrowing down that massive universe of stocks around the world? Is it sort of country by country, like you were just saying? Do you try to go by GDP growth? Is it a, you know, run a screen of valuations? What's the process like to hunt for that next buy?
You're absolutely right, Mike. You know, there's about 3,000 companies in the global index. That's a, you know, a huge amount of companies to follow and stay on top of and be familiar with. And of course, in that, there's lots of companies that you would never want to invest in, you know, state-owned enterprises, these old industrials and telecoms and utility companies or state-owned banks. In general, we're going to sort of avoid already that big part of the market because they're not really run for shareholders. They have other interests at heart. But we really kind of focus on at the industry level. Right. And so we're trying to understand whether it's consumer or industrials or sort of technology, where are the great companies? Where are, you know, innovation? Where are the great brands anywhere in the world? And then so we'll follow that lead.
With that said, Mike, I'm pretty sure it's that time.
It is that time.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Sir, why don't you get us started? You have a bunch of contributions from the voice. Oh, we have a voicemail. Let's play that.
Hi, this is Tim. President Obama's high school basketball jersey got auctioned off for $192,000. This is more than what Michael Jordan's was for $173,000 and LeBron James was for like $185,000 or something thousand. So President Obama's high school jersey for $192,000 was the most expensive high school basketball jersey that has ever been auctioned.
Always great to get a voicemail. Everyone, remember, if you want to give us a call, that number is 646-324-3490. And just as you heard, we may even play your message on the show. But not only did we get a voicemail, as I said earlier, we also got other write-ins too. So first, I'll read this one. This came through on the Bloomberg Terminal from Stephen Kaminsky of Jump Systems. So this is what he said. He said, "We all already know one of the craziest moments in this crazy year was oil going negative in April. Perhaps even crazier, though, is nine traders at Vega Capital were, as a group, the biggest sellers of WTI futures and spreads on that day. They made $660 million. Even the son of one of the Vega traders, who's in his early 20s with limited experience, made $8 million. All caps, wild story. And I do encourage, this is a great story. One of the reporters on this was Liam Vaughn. We had him as a guest on one of our prior podcasts. He's a great, great storyteller. So I encourage you to go read it. And then I'll read the other one as well. This one came through on Twitter from @termmanagement. He said, the craziest thing in markets this week, full disclosure, he wrote this at the end of last week too, but didn't quite make it in because we had already recorded the podcast. He said, Airbnb IPO getting plenty of attention for performance and early trading. Meanwhile, Pebblebrook Hotel Trust, this is PEB, the ticker is, priced $450 million of six-year paper at 1.75%. And then he went on to explain, you may be familiar, but the hotel REITs carry basically all the operational leverage and the operators don't actually have much downside exposure. Current hotel occupancy is in the upper 30s. And then he went on, he goes, and yet creditors underwriting a yield of less than 2%, limitless investor appetite for anything related to the quote unquote reopening trade. And it really is remarkable, Mike.
It really is. That's I believe that's froth with a capital F right there, if I'm not mistaken. But Jensen, I'm curious what you think. You know, we've seen some really eye-popping IPO debuts in the last week or so. You guys seem to focus mainly on the more mature companies. How, you know, big of an IPO, how attractive does an IPO have to be to sort of catch your attention? Or do you like to wait and see that a company's lasted a few years before you get involved?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. You know, some of these IPO companies actually have been, large companies operating at scale for many years. That might not have been the case 15, 20 years ago. Because when you're that large, you know, you've already come public. But now with the strength of the private markets, these companies have not had to. And then, you know, there's other reasons, you know, there's Sarbanes-Oakley's and things that like that have just sort of dissuaded people from coming public. And then the focus on quarterly earnings is sort of a turnoff as well. So there's been good reasons why they've stayed private. You see some of these companies coming out, they're actually relatively mature. We're very valuation sensitive, and so we'll look at some of these, and if it makes sense, participate. But in general, we're really mostly focused on the publicly traded companies out there.
Interesting. All right, Denton, before we put you on the spot for your crazy thing, I'll give you mine via Vildana Heyrich.
And Sarah, I have very high expectations.
It's a good one because it will allow us to play a little prices right here on what this is. Obviously, it's an alternative asset, as you know, as I'm inclined to delve into. Auction in London by Christie's, the first commercially printed Christmas card is up for sale. It's a merry Victorian era scene that scandalized some who denounced it as humbug when it first appeared in 1843. And that great lead is courtesy of the Associated Press. So it was controversial because it's a picture of a family having a big, happy Christmas meal, but they're all drinking wine, and there's even someone offering some wine to a young toddler at the table. So I think the temperance movement in England in the late 1800s was not very happy about this. So so it was very controversial. They say only 1,000 were printed. First commercial Christmas card. 1,000 printed, only about 30 left. Sarah, knowing what you know about the alternative asset space, what's your price on this?
Because you know I'm a professional now in alternative assets.
That's right.
I think the common thread with these prices rights has really been that typically they cost much less than we're inclined to guess. So I'm gonna lowball it, and I'm going to go. I'm going to go $600.
$600. Okay. What a Scrooge. Jeez. $600. Denton, how much are you willing to bid for the first commercially available Christmas card from 1840, I believe it is?
I think I just saw that Gretzky's rookie card went for $1 million.
That was right. That's a good
that
one.
That was actually so that was going to be
first,
my personal
the
crazy
first
thing if
Christmas
we needed it.
Card, you know, maybe not Gretzky levels, but certainly more than 600. Come on, Sarah.
every time we play Price is Right, I guess something ridiculous like $200,000, $5 million, and everything is typically way below what I guess.
So the wise move here, Danton, is for you to bid 601.
That's what I would do.
I'll put you down for 601.
I watched a lot of Price is Right in my childhood, and I would go 601 exactly.
All right. So it hasn't sold yet. It's up for sale, I believe, this weekend. They're thinking between 500 and 800 pounds, so between about $6,700 and $11,000. It seems a little low to me for the first Christmas card. I don't know.
Okay, so I was right in the right range.
You were, yeah. The low ball bid was smart. I was expecting a six-figure bid from you, Sarah. So it's good to see you've got a little price discipline and you.
I've learned to tamp down my expectations.
Right. Even though Sarah did just buy a Peloton, so She's feeling the froth, I think. She's feeling...
I'm going to say it outright. From my perspective, maybe one of my best purchases of 2020.
Yeah? Yeah?
I mean, yeah, I got it on Monday, and I've already used it a couple of times. So,
Have you gotten any shout-outs from the instructors? I feel like you're not really a Peloton rider until one of those people in the Lycra shouts you out in the middle of a ride.
I haven't done any of the live rides yet, but I'm planning to on Sunday. So I'll let you know. I'll let you know if I happen to get a shout out.
All right. Interesting. Now, Danton, I'm not sure if they warned you about this gimmick, but have you seen anything crazy in markets this week you can tell us about?
Yeah. You know, I think there are plenty of things. You know, one of the most amazing things that I've seen is, you know, and of course, Bitcoin has been a lot in the news. And of course, it's hitting records, right? It's tripled this year or more than that. It's, you know, 23,000. So recently somebody launched a crypto index fund. You know, this is the Bitwise 10 crypto index fund. It's the top 10 cryptocurrencies out there, you know, an index fund of that. And so the NAV of that per share is $18.50. Guess what the price per share, and these are just, you know, basically Bitcoins and some other Ether and some other currencies in there. Guess what the price of that per share is?
I'm going to abstain because I read this story.
Okay, yeah.
Sarah, let's get Sarah to bid.
I read it as well.
I mean, so in preparation for this, I looked at the data and I had to call my financials analyst last night and say, can you turn your Bloomberg on and look at this? So see, I'm not misreading this. So, you know,
nope.
The NAV is $18.50. The price is $93, right? So
it's unbelievable.
So the premium is about 400%, 405%, meaning it's trading at 5x, right? So if if Bitcoin, and this is mainly Bitcoin right now, 77% Bitcoin of those 10 currencies, we can debate whether Bitcoin is a bargain or not at 23,000, but paying over 100,000 for Bitcoin when it's trading at 23,000, that just seems crazy.
It makes you wonder that people investing in this index, I mean, can they possibly know what they are doing? Like what they are exactly buying if they're buying it at such a premium,
Right. I mean, you can just go out there and buy the Bitcoin instead, right? At 23,000 instead of buying it for over 100,000.
I think forgive me if I embarrass myself here by talking about crypto, because we all know I'm not exactly the world's leading crypto authority, but I think the issue is you buy some Bitcoin, it's not necessarily safe and secure on some exchange. We read about all these exchange getting hacked and whatnot, and Bitcoin wallets getting looted. So I wonder if part of that premium, because the Grayscale Trust, which is an older mutual fund that buys Bitcoin, has always had a big NAV premium like that. Not quite like that. I think it's, you know, like maybe 30, 40, 50% at sometimes. But I wonder if people are willing to pay up for the security and knowing that someone else is going to store this, keep it safe, and you're not going to wake up and see a zero balance someday if the exchange you're dealing with had gotten hacked. My best guess.
Yeah, no, that could be good. That could be right. You know, or if you stored the information on your hard drive and your girlfriend threw it away and you got to go into the garbage dump looking for the hard drive. But I think part of it maybe is just that there's people out there are comfortably investing in equities this is an equity.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And so it's just easier.
Yep.
You can go onto your brokerage account and buy it easily. You don't have to buy, you know, you don't have to set up a separate sort of crypto account. That might be part
that
of it.
That makes a lot of sense.
But, you know, yeah. But paying 5x just seems
that's
absolutely extreme.
Right. And also in crypto and I guess IPO news, Coinbase has now filed confidentially to go public. So we're just going to ride the crypto train.
that IPO is going to, I won't make any predictions, but boy, that'll be an interesting IPO. We'll see. Well, anyway, maybe, Sarah, maybe if there are some crypto experts, I know we have a lot of crypto experts who listen to us, even though we don't give them a lot of content. But if anyone has any other ideas on why that fund is trading at such a premium, by all means, give our hotline a call and let us know.
Please do. Please do. And unfortunately, we are going to have to leave it there. But Danton Goey, thank you so much for joining the show this week.
Mike, Sarah, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Also, thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Jordan Gaspore. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.